Welcome to the Woodshop Life Podcast, a bi-weekly podcast focused on the craft of woodworking. I'm Guy Dunlap of Guy's Woodshop, and I'm joined by Hui Huynh of the Alabama Woodworker.
Hey, guys.
Hey, and Sean Walker of Simple Cove.
Hello.
Hello. Well, this podcast is intended to answer questions from the woodworking community and give you some of our perspectives on how we get things done in our own shops. I also want to let you guys know we do have a new Patreon account, and right now we have one level, and we are simply asking for a small donation just to try to cover the cost of bringing you this podcast. So please go to patreon.com/woodshoplife, and we sincerely hope that you will give us your support. And I do want to bring up something. We have a, it's not a question, but it's a reply to an episode we did. I think it was episode 2 or episode 3. Don't quote me on that. But we were talking about using MDF as a substrate for veneer and the screw holding strength of it. And one of our listeners, Nicholas Venaria, chimed in. I'm not going to read his whole email, but he says he works for a plywood and hardwood distributor. And he said there's a product out there that's the best of both worlds, and he wanted to share it with us. He said it goes by a few names. It's called FX Platform, Combo Core, Armor Core, Pro Core. I'm familiar with Combo Core myself. Basically, it's a plywood and MDF sandwich, and it's 3/4 inch. It has a 1/4 inch veneer core center with a 1/4 inch MDF laminated to each side of that. So the benefit is you get the dead flatness of the MDF and the screw holding power of regular plywood. And it does come in 4x8 sheets. And it's not the most inexpensive thing in the world, but it's not the most expensive thing in the world either. Now, this stuff is not available in your home store or big box stores, but if you have a hardwood or plywood dealer near you, they'll probably carry it. So thank you, Nicholas, for bringing that to our attention. And I think we're going to get right into the questions. So, Hui, what's your first question?
All right. My first question is from Nate. I want to start by saying that I really enjoy the podcast and it's very beneficial to me. Thank you, Nate. I'm a beginning woodworker, mostly enjoying as a hobby. As a beginner, I'm mostly using the Craig jig as my go-to and would like to eventually get a biscuit joiner. Beyond that, what advice could you give to me to graduate to more complex joinery such as mortise and tenon, dovetails, etc.? Also, any tips and tools you use for your favorite joinery methods would be much appreciated. Keep up the good work. Thanks, Nate. Well, thank you, Nate. I think a great project, and I think this is something that, and I say this actually not ever making this piece that I'm suggesting, but a shaker side table. I've actually never made one, but a shaker side table I think is a great introduction to more complex joinery because you can use things such as mortise and tenon and dovetails. And to be frank, I'm going to say this, and I know some people are going to disagree, but I don't actually think that in order to do mortise and tenon and dovetails that you have to always start by using hand tools. I just don't think it's necessary. I didn't. And for the most part, I think that it's good to use some hand tools when it's necessary, but I don't think that it's always necessary. But I think a shaker side table is a great introduction to doing things like tapered legs, mortise and tenon, machine cut dovetails, or if you want to go the route of hand cut dovetails, you can do that as well. I kind of do a sort of hybrid method of mortise and tenon for the most part. If it's only a few, I'm just going to go to the drill press, hog most of it out, and then just clean it up with some chisels. Or you can use your router table or your handheld router. But I'll tell you, you know, the router is really, you know, you mentioned here the Craig jig, the biscuit joiner. I think after that, really the router is the tool that you kind of want to get introduced to and start using on a somewhat regular basis because it's extremely useful. But guys, Guy, what do you think? What do you think about a shaker side table? Do you think that's a good intro to sort of more advanced joinery?
I think that's an excellent project, and I probably would recommend that myself because it does have a lot of different aspects to it, like you mentioned, the mortise and tenon legs to the aprons. You learn how to make a drawer correctly, how to fit it nice. There's just a lot going on there, and it's a great first project. As far as going beyond something like a biscuit joiner or a Craig jig, you mentioned a lot of ways to go to mortise and tenon, and probably the easiest way is with a drill press and just, you know, hog out the most of it with the drill press and then with a chisel. And if you find yourself doing Morrison tenon joinery quite a bit, you can move up to a, you know, a hollow chisel mortiser, mm-hmm. which is something I use quite often. Well, every time I do Morrison tenon joinery, I'm using a hollow chisel mortiser. As far as dovetails go, I use a jig just because, you know, I don't do dovetail. I may make a half a dozen drawers a year, so I'd have to practice for like 2 weeks with my hand-cut dovetails to actually do it. So it's just easier for me to use a jig. But there's a lot of good stuff out there, and we've mentioned this before. There's a lot of stuff on YouTube, but go to the written word. Look at magazines like Pop Woodworking and Fine Woodworking and Wood Magazine. There's a lot of different books out there on joinery mm-hmm. that will explain it in very easy to understand terms and how to do it correctly and give you a lot of tips. Sean, what's your insights on this?
There is actually a book on joinery that you could look at that guy's talking about. That's a good reference. I agree with you guys. The Schicker side table is perfect. Mortise and tenon, dovetails, get a little experienced with doing the chamfer on the tabletop. To cut the mortise and tenon, I primarily use the router, the plunge router, if it's big enough, or the router table. And I typically don't use the drill press, but again, I just use the router. And I do have a hollow chisel mortiser, but I very rarely use it. The router's my go-to. Now, on the tenons, I don't think that we've covered that. I use either a dado stack for that or a jig that I made for the tenoning jig. Mm-hmm. So if you have a dado stack, you can give that a try. If not, you can make a tenoning jig. It's fairly simple to make, or you can buy one, of course, to help you with that. Now, on the dovetails, I only have, I don't have a router jig for that, so I hand cut those. But there are several options you can do on that to take the hybrid approach, like Hui recently posted on Instagram about his bandsaw jig to cut the tails. Hui, do you want to talk about that for a second?
Yeah, to cut the tails on the bandsaw, it's simply just a wedge that is cut at 7.5 degrees, which is, I believe, a 1:8 ratio. That doesn't matter. It can be whatever ratio you want, whatever angle you want. It's actually better that you figure that out on your own and sort of experiment. But that wedge is just butt up against the fence. The drawer side is then butt up against that wedge. And I just cut the angles and then move the fence over and cut the center angles. If I'm doing two tails or multiple tails, it's just adjusting the fence to where it needs to be. And then just hogging out the waste, that little V notch that's created with a chisel. And then there are ways to cut the pin board on the bandsaw. I'm probably just going to cut it by hand because I don't want to make another jig for it. But there are ways to cut the pin boards on the bandsaw. And there are actually ways to cut dovetails on the table saw if you don't want to drop the coin for a router jig. But honestly, you know, a good router jig goes a long way for cutting dovetails. I know the lead jig is the one that comes to mind because I think it gives you that variable spacing. It is an expensive jig, and it probably would be the only router jig that I would go with if I were to get a router jig. You know, just like you, Sean, I don't have a router jig, so I either cut them by hand or I cut them on the table saw or I cut them on the bandsaw and kind of use that hybrid method.
I do use a magnetic dovetail guide often to cut the dovetails.
Oh yeah, that too. I forgot about that.
Yeah.
The key is to look at the tools you have on hand in your shop. Determine, can you use what you have to cut the joinery and work with that until you get everything down. And then you'll sort of decide on your own what other tools and stuff that you want to buy to make that process easier, because that's pretty much all they're going to do is make it easier and maybe add a little accuracy to it. So look at what you have. If you have a dado stack, you can use that for the tenons. If you have a router, you can use that for the mortises, or you can use a drill press. And also if you have a router, you can buy the dovetail jig. So just look and see what you have in your shop to determine what you have and what you need to buy and go from there.
About the best suggestion I could make.
Are you going to say domino?
No, actually I'm going to say, don't get a domino. Don't get a domino. Don't get a pocket hole jig. Don't get a biscuit joiner. Learn how to do the joinery first.
Mm-hmm. Agree. Yeah.
I see way too many people that have gone right into woodworking and they went right into a domino And they've built some pretty cool stuff. But if you ask them how to do a mortise and tenon, they have no idea how to do it because they've never done it before.
I'm completely guilty of that. I got a domino after 2 years of woodworking. I got it way too soon.
Yeah. So learn how to do the joinery first and then try to find ways to simplify it and make it go faster.
Yeah.
Would be my suggestion. Don't buy the expensive tools. Just learn how to do it with simple tools.
Yep, with simple traditional joinery.
Yeah, and by the way, just so everybody knows, this is not a gouge at the domino. Like, that's a great tool. I think all of us have one, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great tool. It's just, the point is that there's a lot to learn with what you do have. And rather than investing a lot of coin right up front, it would be better and more prudent for you to learn the joinery with what you have before just spending a lot of coin.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I've told people that have asked me, why did you buy a domino? I'm like, I put my time in to learn the joinery. And, you know, sometimes I just want to go a little bit faster, but I've got the foundation and I can do the traditional joinery if I needed to. But sometimes I just want to go a little faster.
Yeah. All right. So, Sean, I believe the next question is yours.
Awesome. So the question from Sunrise Woodshop. Hi guys, I'm loving the podcast. I listen to quite a few woodworking podcasts, and although I do enjoy hearing what folks are up to, sometimes I just want to hear some Q&A. I really like getting your perspectives on listener questions because many times those questions are relevant to what I'm doing or may do at some point. On this week's podcast, you mentioned learning how to apply shellac. How do each of you apply it? I guess I'm going to start off by talking about the different types of shellac that I keep on hand. And I'm just a weekend woodworker, so I don't have a big bag of shellac of different types and stuff. So mainly for the flakes, I keep Super Blonde and Garnet. And I keep a can of Seal Coat from Zinsser. And I keep one spray bottle of the clear shellac. So mainly what I do is I mix the flakes to a 2 pound cut. So that's, I'd mix 8 ounces of denatured alcohol to 2 ounces of flakes. And that allows me to, if I want to put a thick coat down, I've got it. If I want to thin it, I can thin it. I can always thin it if I want to, or if I need to, I can't always make that thicker unless I mix some more. So I always like to mix a 2 pound cut and then thin it accordingly. And how I apply it, if I'm doing a large flat surface, I'll use my Oxhair brush and we'll brush it. But oftentimes I will pat it on with a cotton cloth with some cheesecloth on the inside of that to make a pad. But that's traditionally how I will apply it on things like boxes and real small stuff. But other than that, I brush it on with an Oxhair brush. Guy, what about you? How do you apply your shellac?
Most of the time, and that's the thing, I use a pound and a half cut probably 95% of the time. And we're talking about a pound and a half cut. That means if you took a pound and a half of shellac and mixed it with a gallon of denatured alcohol or Everclear. So I'm using a 1.5 pound cut and it dries really fast. On smaller projects, I will pat it on, like you had mentioned, Sean, which is, you know, a piece of cloth with another piece of cloth on the inside. I call it a rubber, and I rub it on with that. But you have to do it really quickly, and you can't go back. Sometimes it leaves streaks. You have to play with it to really understand how to do it well. If you don't want to go that route, I'd recommend probably a 2 pound cut, like Sean is talking about. It doesn't dry as fast. You have a little bit more time with it, especially on a larger piece. Now, on larger pieces, like a tabletop or something large, I'm going to spray it. I love spraying shellac. It's just wonderful. But mostly, if I'm not spraying it, I'm using the balled up t-shirt, basically, is how I do it. Do you use a lot of shellac, Hui?
Yeah, I use quite a bit of shellac. It's my go-to to seal in if I'm doing an oil base to give some ambering or color. I'm using a lot of shellac. Generally speaking, I'm using a pound and a half cut, but Sean, what you said about having a 2 pound cut on hand and then sort of diluting it, that's pretty cool. I like that idea. But I'm using, I call it a dauber because I don't like using the word rubber.
Why? We're not going to get an explicit rating for you saying rubber.
No, I know, but it's just funny. But I use a dauber, which is a t-shirt with cut up strips of t-shirt inside and then using a piece of twine at the top. I have not sprayed shellac, although I do want to get into actually spraying shellac because I hear that it goes on really nice and very even and you don't worry so much about moving as fast. I will say that you're the second person, Guy, that mentioned Everclear as an alternative to using denatured alcohol. Could you expound a little bit about that? And what do you mean by Everclear and why you would use Everclear maybe over using denatured alcohol?
Everclear is alcohol, obviously, but it's sold in a liquor store. Mm-hmm. And it goes by a lot of different trade names. I know when I lived in Ohio, when I lived in Cleveland, it was illegal in Ohio. I've never tried to find it here. So it might be legal in Indiana, but it's state by state. Now, if you can't get that, you can get denatured alcohol. And what denatured alcohol is, it's Everclear with extra stuff in it that makes it poisonous.
So you can't get drunk on it.
So if you try to drink it, you'll die.
Yeah. So they can sell it in other states.
Yeah. So they can basically sell it in a hardware store for people that want alcohol, and it's very inexpensive. You can also get, you know, Baylin's has alcohol that they sell. You can get, you know, some pretty pure alcohol. That's one of those things I just don't sweat the details about. That's just me. So, yeah. But that's what Everclear is. It's just denatured alcohol that's not poisonous, and it's more expensive.
Sounds like across the board, all of us are using some type of rubber, some type of dauber. Sean, sounds like you're using a Knox hair brush.
An ox hair.
Oh,
yeah,
ox
that's
hair.
What I used.
Sorry.
To.
Ox hair.
Yeah, ox hair.
Sorry, excuse me.
Yeah. Now, there was one thing I wanted to touch on, and that we can all maybe share a tip or two on how to apply it, meaning things to look out for, because when I struggled with shellac when I very first started applying it because it dried so fast. And a couple of things that I ran into is when I would sand in between coats, I would put too much pressure and the scratches were too deep and I would have to take it back until you no longer saw them and then reapply the finish. So very, very, very light pressure when you're sanding in between coats with...
What sort of sandpaper are you using?
320.
Okay.
320 to 400 is what I typically use. Mm-hmm. And just sometimes I would just put too much pressure and it was leaving deep scratches that I had to take back and sand and start over. So be careful on how much pressure you apply. And the second thing is I was applying the second and third, whatever, the subsequent coats too soon. And it was just pushing the shellac around and causing it to look a little streaky. So definitely make sure that you have enough time for each coat to dry before you apply the next coat. Just my personal preference, after a couple, three coats, depending on how thin it is, if I'm doing a 1.5, I'll do 3 coats to 4 coats a day and then let it set overnight. But if I'm doing a 2-pound, I'll apply a couple coats and then I'll let the piece set overnight just to dry a little bit before I continue sanding it and applying the next coat.
That's all good advice. A couple things you have to consider, and you touched on it slightly there, Sean, was that when you apply subsequent coats, it can dissolve the initial coat.
Right.
And that's exactly what it does. Alcohol is a solvent-based finish, kind of like lacquer. So when you apply it, you're not applying layers. You're adding to the existing layer. And that's very important to remember. As you're putting it down, if you put too much on and it pools in an area, it'll dissolve the shellac underneath. So that's important to remember. Another thing I always had a problem with when I first started using shellac about 15 years ago was the edges of the piece, especially on like a tabletop or a large flat surface. You always tend to get more shellac right at the edges where you start and stop. You have to be careful when you're doing that. You do it like some people call it like a plane taking off and a plane landing. You kind of go that way with it. So you don't start right on an edge. Mm-hmm. You start towards the middle and work your way out. And when you're sanding, you always got to make sure you always sand to the edges. Now, when I sand, I use 600 grit very, very lightly. All I'm trying to do is get out any unevenness in the surface. I'm just trying to flatten it out most of the time. I'll go 2 coats of shellac, and then I'll typically let it dry overnight so it's fully cured. Then I'll go over it with 600 grit sandpaper, again, making sure I get the edges. But I don't want to burn through the corners or anything, but I'll sand it down. I wipe it off. I don't worry about if there's any additional dust particles on there from the shellac, because when you put new shellac on, that dust will actually melt into the next coat. That's the main thing to remember. It's solvent-based. When you put more coats on, you're not building up layers. It's all one layer.
It's great for polishing, too, since it's one thick layer.
Yeah, Yeah, there's a, we could have a whole show and talk 3 hours on shellac. It's such a deep subject.
With that being said, I think, Guy, you got the next question, right?
Do I?
Yeah.
Cool. This is a question from Ed in Atlanta. He says, "Hey guys, I have a question about wood movement. He's currently designing a coffee table for a neighbor, and he's making from solid 5/4 walnut. I was thinking about joining the tabletop to the panels that will be the legs with 3 through wedged tenons per leg. The top will be 24 inches wide and the legs being 18 to 20 inches wide. Would wood movement be an issue here? My thinking is that because they are similar widths and made sequentially side to top to side, kind of like a waterfall is what I'm thinking. It's not quite a waterfall, but something like it. They would expand and contract at the same rate. If this is an issue, what would you suggest as a way to join the top without seeing any fasteners?" The easy answer to that question is no, wood movement will really not be an issue there because it's not a cross grain situation. All the grain is going the same way, and you're cutting the leg, then the top, and then the leg and putting it all together. You're cutting it from the same board. So the expansion contraction rate on the same board should be good. In other words, I really wouldn't worry about it. The through tenons, I think that would look really cool, you know, especially wedged through tenons. I really like that look. I don't do it that often, but I think that's a really cool look. And it's not going to be an issue at all. The main time you have problems with wood movement is when you have a cross grain situation. So a good example of that is like a breadboard edge. You have the grain for the table going long ways across the table, and then you put a breadboard on it, on the end of it, and it's going across the grain. So the expansion and contraction of the breadboard ends are going one way, and the expansion contraction of the tabletop is going the other way. So there's a lot of considerations that have to be made on how you attach that to the tabletop. And when you look at, you know, and if you build it in the summer, and then in the winter, when you look at it, you're going to notice that, you know, the top is, you know, if it's a regular tabletop, so it's, you know, 36 to 42 inches wide, it's going to be like a quarter inch. You're going to lose like a quarter inch on the total width of that table, and the breadboard edge is going to be sticking out. But in the summertime, it'll go back. Those are the things to consider. I don't know. Do you guys agree with that, Sean?
Yeah, I guess I'm having a hard time picturing this design. Is it kind of like you're saying, a waterfall?
That's what I'm thinking.
But instead, they're narrower, but underneath the table.
Underneath the table, and then he's going to go through from the legs through the top with wedge tenons.
I look at it as almost like sort of a apronless table.
Yeah.
And so then the legs are actually a solid panel.
Yeah, exactly.
Just a little bit narrower than the top, so they tuck under a little bit. Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think you'll be fine.
All right, Sean's in agreement.
Yep, you got 2 for 2. What's Sweet going to say?
Well, actually, when I read this question and heard the description, the whole time I'm thinking of a shaker stool, and a shaker stool is actually a great example of doing exactly that. Obviously, it's not a waterfall edge, but the direction of the grain for the legs and the top of the stool are both in line with each other. So the movement is in the same direction at the same rate. And especially considering that the same thickness or close to the same thickness, I don't think there's an issue there. I mean, and shaker stools have been around for I don't know how long, a very long time. But if you look at some of the shaker stools out there, the edge dovetails. I mean, it's the same thing if you were to dovetail a box, right? Everything's in the same direction.
I mean, and he's only holding it in place with 3 wedge tenons per leg. So it's not like he's restricting the whole thing. So it can still move. There's so many other examples, but yeah, I agree.
I don't think it's going to be an issue at all.
Yeah. All right. That was an easy one.
That was easy.
So I think we're back to you, Hui.
Yeah, it's back to me. And the next question that I have is from Winter Wolf Woodworking, and it's about shop setup. My wife and I are moving, and I'll be upgrading from a small one-car garage in a 1950s Rambler to a much more modern 3-car garage. I have the go-ahead to turn the third stall into my workshop, and I'll be able to leave my truck in the driveway and basically have 2 stalls to utilize, weather permitting. My first real project will be shop setup and doing a project I've been really dreaming about for years, a real woodworking bench. I'm unsure if I will have this on locking casters for space saving or if I'll keep it stationary. My question is in regards to style for space and versatility. I see all sorts of table options from French Roubaix to English Nicholson and every hybrid in between. And my projects range from small trinkets to larger tables. Larger furniture, excuse me. What would some of the pros and cons be of these benches being movable versus stationary, given their styles? Would a larger assembly table style like the Wood Whisperer circa 2007 be something that would make more sense, considering in the winter I may be dealing with a few feet of snow shrinking my shop back to a single car stall? Well, I can speak to, you know, my own experience in terms of what I have. I have a small workbench. I don't have a big Roubaix style workbench or English Nicholson bench. And it works for me because I'm using hand tools in a very limited capacity. Most of what I'm doing, most of my machining is coming from machines. And so then I'm using my hand tools for finish fitting. And maybe the only time where I'm using hand tools exclusively is if I'm hand cutting, you know, that one drawer or just planing that small board. One thing that I'm not doing is I'm not hand planing a huge dining room table. I just don't do that. And for me, what made sense was actually a relatively small joinery type bench. So it measures, I think, something about 52 inches long and about 24 inches wide. And I have a twin screw vise and I have a sort of it's called an inset vise. It's a Veritas tail vise that's inset into the bench. I actually prefer having a larger assembly table because my assembly table functions not only as an assembly table, but also as an outfeed table. And because I have an array of dog holes underneath, I also use it as a machinery table or a joinery table to hold down work pieces. I prefer it that way. And everything in my third bay, I have a third bay and the two other bays I park my car in. When I need to do things that require more space, I back out my cars. But everything in the third bay is more permanently in place, but still has casters so that when and if I do decide to move to a larger shop, I can move things out of my shop and move them around. Guy, I believe you also have a small joinery bench. Am I correct about that?
Yes, I do. And it's mainly because this is just my feeling anyways. The only time you need like an 8 foot long Roubaix is if you're hand dimensioning all your lumber. So you need that long space. 9 times out of 10, you're only going to be using about 2 or 3 foot of one end of that. The rest of it is just going to get, it's a horizontal surface. It's just going to get covered with crap that you're moving out of the way constantly. So I may just made a small bench. It's got a vise on it, a front vise. I was doing some edge banding yesterday and I had a 9 foot long piece of plywood in that front vise and it held it. No problem. A long bench you really don't need. Now my bench is stationary. It weighs about 300 pounds, give or take 50 pounds, somewhere around there. It's a stout little thing. But everything in my shop, except for that workbench, everything in my shop is mobile. Mm-hmm. That's mainly because it's a two-car garage, and from mid-October to May, a car has to be put in the garage, which is my wife's car. The rest of the year, I don't have to move it. In the summertime, she'll park outside. But when it's cold outside, you know, like today, it was 19 degrees when we got up. She doesn't want to have to, you know, go outside in the cold, which I understand, and I'm cool with that. Everything is mobile because I tend to move equipment around to better utilize the space I have for different tasks that I may be doing. Like right now, I'm building cabinets. So my shop setup is a little bit different because I have to have room for all these cabinets that I'm building and still be able to get a car in there.
Guy, can I ask you something really quick? How long does it take you to set up your shop from the time your wife leaves in the morning? How long does it take you to do that?
For me to set everything up, I actually did a real-time video on it. It's on my Instagram, and also I did a shop tour on my YouTube page, my last one, and it takes about 2.5 minutes.
Yeah.
It takes me longer to break down because I sweep. Sweeping takes me about 5 minutes. So in 10 minutes, I can have it broke down swept up and a car back in the garage.
Yeah.
But that's just because I've had it set up that way for so long, and it's, you know, it's just, it's like second nature to me. And a lot of people say, oh man, you know, cars should live outside and blah, blah, blah. It's like, nah, it's not a big deal.
Right.
The only time it's a problem is like, sometimes she'll come home early.
Mm-hmm.
I'll be right in the middle of something, you know, and you've got that in your head and you're motoring along. And all of a sudden I get the text, I'm on my way home. I'm like, ah.
In the middle of a glue up. Does that ever happen?
Yeah. Yeah. In which case I'll text her back, say, you know, park outside and I'll pull your car in later.
Yeah.
Unless it's snowing out, then, you know, that's not going to happen. For the most part, you know, mobile on everything is good. Even the big Rubos I've seen with mobile hardware. Rockler makes a really good set of casters for workbenches where they sit on the floor. And when you put the casters up, they're all on casters and, you know, one hand will move it. I recommend casters for everything. Even if you think it's going to stay there permanently, mm-hmm. put it on casters and just lock the casters because you never know when you're going to move it.
I want to speak about one tool that I have that I actually called the company and opted not to have the stand because I prefer to build a cabinet for all my tools and then put casters on that cabinet so that I have that additional storage. And that's my Supermax drum sander. When I ordered my drum sander, I actually requested not to have the stand included because I actually...
Yeah, I remember talking to you about that.
Right. And they gave me a little discount for the drum sander. I think they took like $100 off for not having, because it came in a separate box.
I kept the stand and put a piece of MDI on top of it, and I use it as a rolling cart.
Oh, that's pretty. There you go. There you go.
I actually ended up giving it away, but...
great to move lumber around, right? Pieces.
Yeah.
Yeah, that you're milling.
Yep. Yeah. What about you, Sean?
Well, I guess I, with my shop set up, is everything is, I park outside now, so everything is in its place. But I've rearranged my setup 3-4 times. And even though everything is stationary, I still highly recommend putting everything on a mobile base so you can move it, especially with your setup. You said that you may be going down to one bay in the wintertime and whatnot. Mobile. You got to go mobile on everything. And you also mentioned, would a larger assembly table be something that would make more sense considering the winter? I may be dealing with a few feet of snow, shrinking my shop back to a single car garage. If this is just my opinion, but if it were me and I knew that there are going to be times that I'm down to one bay, I'm going to go with a shorter workbench. Like I've got maybe a 5 or 6 foot workbench. And then I would go with something similar in size for like a smaller outfeed or assembly table that are the same height so that you can put those together, put a sheet of plywood over it. And you now have a larger assembly table, but if you need to, you can move them apart and you have two smaller tables. I know the larger assembly table that I have takes up quite a bit of room in the shop. So if you're not sure if you're going to be in two bay or one bay, I would make everything mobile and then just make a smaller workbench and a smaller assembly table that you can put together for larger projects.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, nice. Sean, I think you've got the next question now.
Awesome. So this one is from Jonathan Scott, and he says, okay, semi-odd question and a bit long. I stumbled across this tool last year called a V drum sander. It's also sold as a Flatmaster drum sander. Apparently it used to be sold as plans to make your own, but it claims to do way more than a drum sander and that it can act as a joiner and accomplish milling perfectly flat boards with sandpaper that floats around the spinning drum and never clogs up because of centrifugal force. I know that all sounds nuts. I think so too, but I never hear anyone talk about it. And the video seems kind of convincing. Have you guys heard of this? And what do you think about how it works as described? I don't have tons of space and have been considering it as a useful multi-purpose addition to the shop. Thanks for starting a podcast based solely around answering the questions from the community. So if you've not heard of this, the V drum sander or the Flatmaster drum sander, imagine a table that is roughly 16 inches wide, 28 inches long, with a 2-inch cutout in the center for a drum sander, like a drum, a two-inch drum, 2 or 3-inch drum. And the sandpaper on it, first of all, the drum is a little bit lower than the table. It's not flush with the table. And the sandpaper on the drum, according to the design of this Flatmaster, the sandpaper is a little loose so that when it spins, it becomes flush with the surface. And due to the centrifugal force, it doesn't clog. So anything that you run across it, whether it has varnish on it or glue on it, it doesn't clog. So that's one of the selling points. So if you don't have a drum sander, you can make one of these. I know they used to sell plans. I don't know if you can get those anymore, but there are a few people online that have made their own. And there's a video that I saw from Blake Weber that made a pretty cool little contraption that mounts on top of his drum sander. And it acts kind of like a jointer using the drum sander instead of blades. So he was flattening boxes and all kinds of stuff on it. But the selling point is, I guess, it's they call it a poor man's drum sander that you can make or buy. It looks pretty cool. And I know it takes off, you know, 10 thousandths per pass. It doesn't gum up. I don't know. I personally probably wouldn't use it. It seems pretty cool, but I have a drum sander and I would probably rather use that. Or the video shows an example of them flushing up some dovetail joinery. And the selling point was it won't gum up if you got glue squeeze out. I don't know. I just think there are cheaper ways to handle that, like using a hand plane or an orbital sander or something like that. It's pretty cool looking in that you can flatten smaller pieces, and it's using sandpaper instead of the blades, like if you were to flatten the bottom of a box. I'll link to this video from, I guess, their website that you can see, and also this the video on Blake Weber's YouTube channel where he builds the attachment for his drum sander, because that's another alternative to this Flatmaster drum sander. But Guy, I know that you've said that you've heard of this before a long time ago. What are your thoughts on them?
Yeah, I think it's an interesting concept. You know, I bought my drum sander mainly because I used to quite a bit, and I still do now and then, is cut my own veneer. And I want to be able to sand it down to a 16th or in some cases a 32nd of an inch. And that's something you could not do on that, because you have to hold the board above it and you have to feed it through. I don't know. I think there's a lot of other ways to get the same thing done versus that. And I think just for me, it didn't have a place in my shop and my workflow. But it's a neat idea. But again, for me, it didn't fit in my workflow. Are you familiar with what we're talking about, Hui? Have you ever seen this?
Yeah, I saw it, and I saw it a long time ago. And I know it sounds terrible, but I kind of wrote it off because it just seemed like clunky. it seemed kind of clunky. Like it would take a really, really long time to flatten a board if you were using it as a jointer. I've seen folks use it simply just to as a drum sander. But see, the way I'm using a drum sander, and correct me if I'm wrong, I think Sean and Guy, you're using it the same way. When I'm resawing things and I want to take it to that final thickness, and I can't use my jointer or my planer for that. But for instance, if I'm making bent laminations or if I'm making shop sawn veneers, the drum sander is my go-to machine. And I'm already using a jointer and a planer, so it doesn't. That kind of a tool doesn't make sense for me because I can't get all of my veneers to, I find it to be difficult to try to get all of my veneers or all of my bent laminations to that exact thickness using this kind of a tool.
Yeah. There's a way to get 16th of an inch veneers through your thickness planer. You build up
a sled.
You basically put a sled on there, and Michael Fortune has a really good way of doing it where he bends the wood and kind of puts it through.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I saw that.
My problem always with that is that it always rips up the edges, the ends as it goes through. And I always had bad luck with it. So I'd always make the boards a lot longer than I would have to. You know, and to be honest with you, almost everything I make goes through the drum sander. I keep 120 grit sandpaper on it. And I run it through almost everything just one time. I put plywood through it so I don't have to use the orbital sander because I've got it there. It takes me a minute to set up. Boom, boom, one pass, I'm done. I don't use it as a thicknesser. It's a sander. And that's the big thing that people get wrong about that is they try to use it as a thicknesser. It's not. It's a sander. You're taking very, very light passes with it. It saves me a ton of time. Again, like these cabinets I'm building now, all the parts went through the drum sander.
Nice.
Now the Flatmaster, I probably didn't do a very good job of explaining. Imagine a jointer that has an infeed and an outfeed and a cutter head in the center.
Yeah.
Replace that with a drum sand or drum, and that's essentially what you're looking at. The table configuration is a little different, but imagine that instead of a cutter head, you've got the drum. So you're pushing everything, you're feeding it through like you would over a joiner head. You're pushing it with your hands over the drum, and it's just using sandpaper to sand it to either flatten it or to remove glue or whatever you're using it. In my opinion, it's very limited as far as what I would use it for. If you can find plans out there for it and you have an extra motor and a drum and you want to give it a go, you can use it like the Weber YouTube video. He used it to flatten the bottom of boxes. Mm-hmm. So his table is a whole lot larger than what the Flatmaster table is, but you know, he's running the bottom of his boxes over it. And since, you know, it's taking off very little, he was able to flatten the bottom of his boxes.
Yeah. But you can do the same thing with the drum sander.
Yep.
Yeah. But I mean, then again, we're talking about probably $150 to $200 worth of material versus whatever for a drum sander. If that's why they call it a poor man's drum sander.
Yeah. Right?
You know, if you don't have the money for a drum sander, this is an option, or you can make your own drum sander. So
one thing I always wanted to have, if I had the room for it, would be a large edge sander.
Yeah.
I'd love to have something like that. I just don't have the room for it. And they're so darn big.
Yeah.
Yep. So, Guy, off to you.
The last question is to me.
Yes.
Sweet. So this is from Hubble Wood Shop, who I follow on Instagram. He makes some really great stuff. I can't think of your first name. I apologize.
Taylor.
What's that?
His name is Taylor. Taylor Hubble.
Taylor.
Yeah.
Cool.
Cool guy. Cool guy.
Yeah, he is. His question is in two parts. Hardwood suppliers in my area offer rough and S3S, which is surfaced three sides lumber, and it's obviously at different prices. What value do you see in each option? Secondly, I am trying to improve my wood selection, keeping in mind grain pattern and unique pieces. Do you have any recommendations in selection, particularly with regarding to rough sawn lumber? Thank you. Okay. First part of the question, values of S3S versus rough lumber. I buy all my lumber in rough format, mainly because if it's surface three sides, that's typically two flat faces and one ripped edge. Wood's going to move after its initial milling. So if you buy 4/4 lumber and it's been surfaced three sides, it's probably close to 3/4 of an inch already, which is where most of your furniture parts go to in size, and that board has any twist or cup to it, you're going to have a hard time getting that out without really thinning the board out quite a bit. If you buy 4/4 rough lumber, it's actually usually, typically, it's like, you know, an inch and an eighth or so in most cases. Mm-hmm. And you can do the initial milling on it, let it sit, you know, get it down to like 7/8 of an inch. And that's what I typically do. I'll take the rough lumber. I'll pull the parts out of it while it's still rough with my bandsaw. And then, you know, keeping some of the pieces, you know, large as I can, but I don't want, you know, 8-foot long boards if I don't have to. And then I'll do the initial milling on it. And then I let it sit. And when I'm getting ready to make that part for whatever I'm making, then I do the final milling on it. And I do the joinery right away. I don't give the wood time to move, if that makes sense. If you have a choice of rough or surface three sides lumber, get the rough lumber. That is, if you have a good joiner and thickness planer. Or, you know, you prefer to do it by hand. You know, that's a whole another subject. Secondly, his other question was wood selection, keeping in mind grain pattern and unique pieces. Typically, when I'm building a project, I'll pull out some boards that I can tell are roughly the same color. It's hard to do when it's in the rough state, but you can get a better idea of the color at least. Then I'll take it, and I've got a number 5 hand plane I have set up as a scrub plane. And I'll take off some of the rough surface so I can see the grain patterns underneath and where I'm going to get my parts, where I'm going to pull my parts from. So I also have a Festool Rotex sander that sometimes I use if I'm just too lazy to use the hand plane. and take off some of that. And I'll go around in different spots on the board and say, okay, I've got some straight grain here. Okay, this is a cool cathedral. This is a nice swirl. This will be perfect here. So I'll kind of go around the board and look at the different things. And I'm thinking about what I'm going to do with those parts from that grain pattern. And I'll usually mark them out in chalk. And so I don't forget what they are. I take a picture of it with my phone. I know it sounds silly and it's maybe pants and suspenders, but it helps me out quite a bit. Okay, I'm done. How would you answer those questions, Hui?
Well,
in 30 seconds.
Great.
Go.
S3S, a lot of times where I see that being used is in cabinet shops that are making a lot of face frames. And the reason is because it saves a lot of time in the milling process. And I know this for a fact because a couple of cabinet shops that I visited here, they actually buy their lumber S3S. Again, the reason why they told me that they do it is because it saves them time. Myself, I buy all of my hardwood either skip plane because skip planing exposes some of the grain so you can see that it's sort of like hand planing, taking the number five as a scrub plane and just seeing what the grain looks like. Or I'm buying it completely rough, not, you know, right off of the bandsaw and dried. The benefit behind using the rough lumber is the way you stated, Guy. I've bought S3S a couple of times, and almost every single time that I've bought S3S, the wood has moved on me. Didn't matter. I still had to go through the joiner and the planer. When you're buying lumber S3S, generally speaking, it's not nearly as thick as the rough. The few times that I've done it, I've gotten a little bit nervous getting to my final thickness. Rather than do that, I'd rather just have material as thick as I can get it within reason. You know, 1 1/8 is generally what I'm getting, 5/4 in the rough. And
I buy a lot of 8/4 stock and I resaw it. That way I can get, you know, good grain match.
And that was the next thing I was going to suggest.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Oh, no. Go ahead.
Well, that's all I was going to say is that I buy 8/4 quite a bit.
Yeah, that was going to be the next suggestion that I was going to give Taylor is buy 8/4 when you can get it, because then you can start doing book matches, and book matches are just absolutely gorgeous, especially if you've got some crotch figure or if you've got some burls or whatnot. And just in general, even if you have straight grain or if you have a little bit of sapwood, you can match that up. And now rather than getting rid of that sapwood, you can actually use it to book match a panel or whatnot.
Sapwood?
A little.
Sapwood. Sapwood is evil.
Oh, you don't like sapwood. Yeah, I don't find it that bad. Particularly if it's a small panel.
It's evil. Heretic.
But sapwood. You know, try to get 8/4 when you can, because you can actually do a little bit more with it. And now you know you have panels that are matching or that will look good coming together edge jointed.
Yeah, it's color matching and yep. Grain matching. Yep. It's even if you're not book matching it, it's just a great way to go.
Yeah. How about you, Sean? What do you do?
I primarily buy rough, and one reason is what you guys talked about. It's already been milled, so not much room left to flatten it, but it's also more expensive. If I've got the tools, no need to spend extra money on me buying S3S lumber. If I can save a little bit, have thicker boards, mill it myself. I will, however, pick through the S3S stack. Like when I was making my bar stools, there were some really curly cherry. There was probably two boards in there that were really curly that were already S3S that I knew were going to be used on thinner parts. So of course I picked through it, bought it, paid a little bit more for it, but it was already milled. So I knew exactly what it was going to look like. And it was thinner than 3/4. So if you're planning for a project that's a little bit under 3/4, S3S is an option if they'll let you pick through it. Some places won't, but that's the only time that I will buy S3S is if I see something that sticks out. And sometimes, even if I don't have any project plan for it and I see something really awesome in the S3S pile, I'll stick it in the lumber rack and hang on to it for a box or something like that. Now, as far as the wood selection, every time that I get lumber, for the most part, I know what I'm going to be making. So if it's rails and stiles, I'll look for boards that are decently wide that have some straight grain pieces on the end, on the edges. And then if it's a panel on a door, I'll look and see if it's got some nice cathedral pattern on the center of the board. But I really enjoy, if you've watched anything on my Instagram, I like getting the really, really wide lumber at my local hardwood dealer because I have that option. I get to choose the edges of the boards have the straighter grain and the inside has the, or the center of the board has the cathedral pattern. So I like getting the wider lumber because there's a little bit of everything in it. But just have a keep in mind what you're going to be making when you go pick your lumber out, because that'll help you determine what to pick and what to avoid, like sapwood on the edges. Are you going to have enough width if you remove the sapwood?
I'm in a weird situation here. I do not have a local hardwood dealer. There's one in town and his prices are just outrageous. You know, like $12 a board foot for walnut kind of prices. There's a lot of guys around here that have sawmills because Woodmiser is based here in Indianapolis. So if you go on Craigslist and search lumber, there's 80 guys selling lumber. The thing is, it's all common. So you're only going to get about a, if you're lucky, a 30 to 40% yield out of it because it's just all knots and it's all, it's common. It's just not, it's not first and select or first and selects or select and better. It's kind of, I wouldn't say garbage wood, but you're just not going to get that high of a yield out of it. My local hardwood supplier is an hour and a half away. I don't have the luxury of driving out there and picking through stacks of lumber. I just call them up and say, I need 50 board feet of FAS 5/4 Pennsylvania cherry. And the truck shows up and they deliver it for me. And I get what they give me. It's good and bad. So,
well, it's expensive.
Not buying it from that place, it isn't.
Oh, it isn't.
No, no. That's where the local guy that charges $12 a board foot for walnut.
Yeah.
That's where he gets his lumber.
Oh, okay. I thought they were one and the same.
No. There's the local hardwood dealer, I'm not going to mention, very expensive and it's about a half hour drive for me.
Gotcha. Okay.
Way out in the country, out in the middle of nowhere near the Ohio state line is where I get my lumber from. They're one of the largest suppliers of quarter sawn wood in the world. I know it sounds crazy, but they are. They ship all over the globe. They're one of the largest sawmills this side of the Mississippi. Like I said, they're here in everybody that has a furniture shop here in Indianapolis. That's who they buy from because they're in the area three times a week. You call them up on Monday, they're delivering it on Wednesday.
Nice.
But the thing is, you don't get to pick your lumber.
Right.
I don't get to pick through any stacks of lumber. However, they know what I'm making. They know I'm not a cabinet shop belting out, you know, cabinet face frames and doors and things like that. They know I'm building fine furniture. All the wood I've been buying from them for 20 years now. And the wood I get from them, they know what I'm using it for, and they give me that. I have always gotten very, very nice boards from them. I have never been unhappy with anything from them.
Nice.
I said it's a blessing, but sometimes I wish I could go pick through a pile of boards and get exactly what I want.
Yeah.
So I think that's going to do it for the show. Please remember this podcast is here to answer questions from the woodworking community. So if you have woodworking questions you would like answered, you can send them through the podcast contact page at woodshoplifepodcast.com or DM us through Instagram at woodshoplife. And you can reach me at guyswoodshop.com. And where can you be found, Hui?
You can reach me at alabamawoodworker.com. And Sean, where can we reach you?
SimpleCove.com and on social media at SimpleCove.
All right. Well, very good, guys. And we'll talk to you in a couple weeks.
Talk to you later.
See ya.